What you are about to hear is the story of a connection that was made between a television series and a viewer's life. Our television set sits in the corner of our living room, befriending us, educating us, inspiring us, making us laugh or cry or tear our hair out in frustration. It is a far more constant companion than most of the friends we will ever make, or even our family. The You and Who books are the story of that companionship, that connection, as told by the people who watch the programmes that make us come alive, chiefly, of course, Doctor Who. This podcast will relate some of those stories. You're listening to You and Who Talking, and I'm J.R. Southall, the creator and chief editor of the series.
I Was a Teenage Time Lord by Rob Irwin, 35, Sydney, Australia. Favourite Doctor, Peter Davison. Favourite Story, The Caves of Androzani. My earliest memory of Doctor Who comes from the late 1970s. The actual year is shrouded in mystery, but for argument's sake, let's say it was 1978, and I was probably 2, going on 3 years old. I remember my older brother inviting me to watch television with him in the spare room. Or maybe it was the living room, I can't really remember. Not that it matters, this was my big brother encouraging me to come and watch television with him, and I was up for it. Next thing, the strangest music I'd ever heard in my, admittedly short life, began playing. It reverberated in my head and I began to lose my composure, and when the woo-woo part started, I fled the room in terror. It would be years before I watched Doctor Who again. By the early 1980s, I was a little more grown up, meaning I could now hold my own against the theme tune, and I started to see more of the series because, as an Australian, we had repeats available on our government-run television station every night of the week. A very different experience to our UK cousins. These episodes I duly took in, enjoying the stories for what they were, but not being obsessive about them either. If I missed an episode or two, for example, or went on holidays with my family for the week, I didn't care about what might be happening on the box. So you could say I was a regular viewer, but certainly not a fan by any stretch of the imagination. In 1986, however, that all changed. That was the year the great love affair started and Doctor Who got into my DNA. And, like most good love affairs, it's perhaps easier to tell you how it started, rather than why. Basically, I was 11 years old, and able to travel around town on my own, plus high school was beckoning in the new year. In this new, more grown-up environment, I started to notice Doctor Who magazine in the newsagents and Target novelizations on the shelves of those newsagents as well as other bookstores. I began to buy the magazine, perhaps out of curiosity. I really don't recall the moment I made the decision to take that first step, and then some of the novels, before finding myself rapidly pulled into this strange new world. Old episodes that I'd seen several times already, thanks to that repeat schedule here in Australia, were now put into greater context through the magazine and the novels. People would write in the magazine about things I'd seen on television the previous week, as if seeing it was the equivalent of finding Tutankhamun's treasure. Strange and expensive merchandise beckoned to me. 25mm, 40mm and 80mm miniatures of the characters. Do I have to choose one scale? Calendars featuring art by Andrew Skilleter. By gosh, that guy could draw. Mythmakers VHS tapes. I was fascinated by the thought of watching interviews with Doctor Who actors because you just didn't see that sort of thing on television. And what on earth lay inside the Doctor Who magazine Winter Special? Where could I buy such wondrous items to worship in my bedroom? While my head was still spinning from this first flush of young love for the series and its merchandise, the Trial of a Time Lord screened on Australian television, and whatever we might say about it from the comfort of 2011, when that opening scene with the space station came on screen, I could have stood up and cheered. In fact, I probably did. This was my show, which none of my friends really understood, and it was definitely uncool to watch, and yet here it was, looking better than it had ever looked before. I'd started high school in 1987, and as luck would have it, my afternoon bus home left from just outside the local library. This meant I could spend some time before my bus arrived, each and every day, looking at the Doctor Who books, learning more and more facts about the series, and generally being a complete geek. It was great. There was an amazing array of 1970s hardback Doctor Who novels on the shelves, perhaps untouched since that decade, as well as newer hardcover reference books. Peter Haining became a god to me. I memorised the episode guide in the rear of Doctor Who A Celebration until I could recite the entire era of each Doctor, barely pausing for breath. I even took to photocopying the front covers of old Doctor Who novels and building a scrapbook of the images I captured. One of these afternoons, I was at the help desk inquiring if a copy of The Five Doctors could be brought over from a nearby library, as all the local libraries had some sort of reciprocal sharing agreement with each other. An older boy came up to me as I finished giving the librarian my details, slightly wide-eyed, and asked if he'd just heard correctly. Was I really requesting The Five Doctors? I nodded in the affirmative, so he began a well-rehearsed spiel about being president of the local Doctor Who club called Time Flight. I was impressed by his sales patter and joined Time Flight on the spot, opening up an even bigger world of geekdom. Here was a group of people in my local area, just like me. It was amazing, although I must confess my parents were initially skeptical of letting me hang around with this new crew of Doctor Who obsessed people. But they soon met them and grew used to them and would drive me over to the monthly meetings where the club would watch old episodes. The president had videotaped just about everything that had screened over the past few years, which in Australian repeats was quite a lot, and we'd talk about the series over cups of raspberry cordial. This led, as it does, to attending even bigger fan gatherings. Looking like some kind of geeky 80s street gang, the Time Flight members would get on a train and trundle into Sydney, where all the other local clubs would converge for parties, as the irregular gatherings of the Australasian Doctor Who fan club were known. From there, we graduated to small conventions. One called Console 88 comes immediately to mind, because it was the first time I'd met people from the series, in the form of Mark Strickson and Julie Brennan. Not long after that, and still in our teens, we found ourselves playing unplanned, yet extremely active roles in local fandom. We were making fanzines, and the fact I became a journalist later in life can probably be traced back to this era. We were appearing on television programs, talking about our passion for the show. We were making fan films, and we were putting on skits and entertainment at fan gatherings. I remember one of them was a whodunit. Get it? Written by Kate Orman and featuring multiple Time Flight members, including myself portraying Andrew Cartmell. Don't ask. And then, slowly, it all started to grind to a halt. Doctor Who was cancelled in 1989, and over the next year or two, I guess it began to sink in that the great love affair was all over. I suppose it was akin to a lover who says they're just nipping out for some milk but still hasn't returned years later, and eventually you just have to let them go. Oh sure, there were still some novels being written, even by people I knew well, in some cases, but they weren't new television episodes, and at that time, if it wasn't Doctor Who on the television, it simply wasn't Doctor Who to me. For 26 years, television had been the medium for most new Doctor Who material, so anything calling itself new Doctor Who just seemed weird. The fact I was also heading towards the end of high school, thinking more about girls, learning to drive, worrying about university and so on, didn't really help much with the equation either, I suppose. In my mind, the BBC had killed the series just as it had got to an interesting phase in its development. I'd grown up, and that's all there was to it. Hey-ho. So what brought me back? How do I find myself here today in a book filled with anecdotes from other Doctor Who fans? Strangely enough, it was the TV movie in 1986. While I hated much of it, some of its elements, like the new-look TARDIS interior and the character of the Eighth Doctor himself, were real winners for me. It inspired me to start reading the BBC's Eighth Doctor novels with some of the old passion I used to have, and within a year or two, Big Finish were making new audio adventures featuring several past Doctors. What was going on here? From there, it was only a few short years of new Doctor Who being a strange mishmash of novels, audios and comics, and before we knew it, there was a new series on our screens in 2005 to crown it all. A real series. Doctor Who was back on television. By the time Rose ran in rather cheesy slow motion to join the Doctor at the end of the first episode, I knew that I had been drawn in again. It might not have been the same youthful rush of blood to the head like in the 1980s, but it was still a love rekindled, and in a sense, the series felt like the lover who nipped out for some milk had finally come home at last. And you know what? The grin hasn't left my face since. Long may the Doctor continue on our screens around the globe. Taken from You and Who, a Doctor Who Fan Anthology.
And that was Rob doing a reading from the first Ewan Who book. Is that right?
That's right. I was so excited to be in print. It was awesome.
Oh, well, I was so excited to have my name on the side of a book. It was bizarre. So for anybody who's not aware, for anybody who missed the first installment of this, this is Ewan Who Talking, in which Rob and I'm J.R. Southall, as you probably heard at the start of the episode, are presenting readings from the Ewan Who books and hopefully some new readings in the style of the essays from the Ewan Who books. So, Rob, you have been a contributor to, well, I think all of the Ewan Who books, haven't you?
All the Doctor Who-based ones, yeah.
Yeah, and, well, obviously I was the editor of one, as people will have heard. So, shall we say what the Ewan Who books are about?
Yeah, absolutely. The Ewan Who books are about people's relationships with, well, originally it was with Doctor Who. Obviously, they've branched out now into all types of topics, including David Bowie, for example, and Douglas Adams. But the ones I've contributed to are all about not so much your reviews of episodes, but how maybe an episode has reached out and touched you, or maybe how the show has reached out and touched you and affected you over the years. Maybe when you were young, maybe when you're older. It could be anything. It can happen in 1,001 different ways, and that's really the beauty of the essays in these books. Everyone's talking about Doctor Who, but in such different ways. It's incredible.
Yeah, it could be meeting somebody from the series. It could be buying something that sort of kickstarts your fandom. It could just be sitting down and watching an episode of Doctor Who and coming to some sort of, you know, some sort of realization about yourself or about your relationship with the program or whatever. It can be anything.
It might remind you of a particularly happy time in your life or a particularly sad time. Yeah, anything at all.
Yeah. So your essay from the first Ewan Who book was about your development into a Doctor Who fan, I guess.
That's right. You know, going from a very small child who couldn't take the theme music playing, I'd run away from the room just screaming in terror. through to buying Doctor Who magazine, at which point I think you're pretty much a fan if you're buying Doctor Who magazine, and, you know, being the only kid at school watching Colin Baker episodes and all these memories that come back, and, you know, I just tried to fit that into an essay.
And we're going to have a second essay from you now, which we won't always necessarily have two essays on each episode. We'll see how long the essays are, and we'll try and organise the episodes so that they're about 15 minutes-ish each. But we're going to have a second essay from you now, and so what have you chosen for your second essay?
This is from one of the Ewan Who Contact Has Been Made books, which came later on in the series, and I'll be talking about Amy's Choice and how that story affected me.
Ah, interesting. Well, I was going to ask you what you were going to talk about, but actually, we might as well just play the file and let people hear from themselves.
Yes, let's hear from this wonderfully handsome chap with the dulcet tones.
And then next week, or next time one of these episodes come out, we'll have somebody else who's not one of the two presenters, now that we've got these pilot episodes out of the way.
Yes, it's not ego, folks. We just wanted you to see how this is done, what it's like, and hopefully you'll be submitting and we'll be playing all of you in the very near future.
Excellent. Right, let's hear your second essay then.
Okay. Real Time Travel, Amy's Choice by Rob Irwin, 37, Sydney, Australia. First story, Revenge of the Cybermen. Unlike some episodes of post-2005 Doctor Who, which get better following a second or even third viewing, Amy's Choice is an episode that I loved, without exception, the first time around. Later on, when I started to think about this and analyse why the episode had grabbed me right away, when other episodes in the 2010 series hadn't done the same, I was carried away in my mind to a few moments in time when, as a much younger fan, Doctor Who had made a real impact on me. It's early 1987. I've been watching The Trial of a Time Lord on Australian television and, on the whole, quite enjoying it. Enter the final couple of episodes where the brown stuff well and truly hits the spinny thing. The Valyard is the Doctor. Well, sort of. He's an amalgamation of the darker side of the Doctor's nature, according to the Master. Somehow, the Doctor's darker side becomes personified in the future, and it's this bloke. Wow! My 11-and-a-half-year-old mind is blown. How is this possible? Does this mean we'll see this guy in future stories? We have to, surely? So many questions. It's now later in 1987, the nights are cold, and I'm tucked up in bed, happily reading The Mind Robber, being an old Patrick Troughton story that my now 12-year-old self thinks there's no chance of seeing any time soon. This is a real link to the show's past. I'm devouring page after page and totally engrossed in what's happening in the land of fiction. Situations seem real and threatening until our heroes start denying the situations exist. Similar to when I was watching The Trial of a Time Lord earlier in the year, my mind is consumed with crazy ideas. What's real? What's fantasy? Remember, this is years before The Matrix came out in the cinema. If I was in the Doctor's shoes and faced with something scary, would my first inclination be to deny it, or just react to it? I went to school the next day, staring out the bus window and probably thinking far more existential thoughts than my pals. I'm now 13 and a half years old, in late 1988, when the Target novelisation of The Edge of Destruction lands in my hands, probably at a Doctor Who fan gathering in Sydney. Similar to The Mind Robber, this is a story I don't think will be very easy to track down in episode form, so the novel's my key to understanding it. Let's go! I instantly fall in love with the concept of a story set in the TARDIS. I'm surprised at how a normally safe place, there's usually no safer place in any Doctor Who story, can suddenly be so scary and weird. Everyone goes nuts. Ian tries to throttle the Doctor. Crazy, the story is so bizarre in places and so different to normal Doctor Who stories in general that I'm quite charmed and it becomes a bit of a favourite. Now fast forward to mid-2010. I'm a couple of weeks off turning 35 years old, sitting in my lounge room with my wife watching Amy's Choice. Suddenly, I get an old tingle down the back of my spine. What's real? What's fantasy? Am I seeing a true reality here, or is a pregnant Amy and a ponytailed Rory really living in a quiet village just too absurd to be real? What about these violent pensioners? Surely they're too crazy and over the top. Or are we meant to think that as a diversion to the truth? Oh, my aching head. But wait, there's more. They're now back on the TARDIS and there's no power. The Doctor, Amy and Rory are trapped. They're freezing. That place that is normally the safest place in the whole universe is going to kill them. It's deadly yet beautiful at the same time. Surely this is the correct reality. Meanwhile, in between all these scenes flits the character known as the Dream Lord. Who is this bloke? And then the big reveal. The Dream Lord is, in effect, the Doctor. His darker side, of course. Sure, these might not have been everyone's reactions when they watch Amy's Choice, but when I see the Dream Lord, I think Valyard. When I think about the village full of violent pensioners or the thread about deciding what is real, I think Land of Fiction. When I think about the frozen TARDIS with no power, I think of a Hartnell story. And yet, no personal flashbacks to earlier stories are needed to enjoy the episode at all. Indeed, The Trial of a Time Lord, The Mind Robber and The Edge of Destruction aren't referenced or even implied in any way during the episode. Amy's Choice is a great example of a story that, on one level, tells an entertaining story to anyone who cares to tune in. On another level, meanwhile, it quite unintentionally takes the fan in me back to when I was a kid and as in love with Doctor Who as I am today. That is magic. That is real time travel. Taken from You and Who, Contact Has Been Made.
You've been listening to You and Who Talking, presented by Rob Irwin with J.R. Southall. The You and Who books, from which all royalties are paid to charity, are available in print and for Kindle from watchingbooks.weebly.com.